Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was wild. It was dangerous. Explosions. Injuries. No, not the war for independence, but how we used to celebrate Independence Day. On today's show, we go back 100 years, even more, to see how Michiganders used to mark the 4th of July. Then we speak with Marty Jo Link, the author of the new book, Bootstrapper, a memoir from broke to badass on a northern Michigan farm. But first, to anyone who endured the dark days of the Great Recession with the near-death ordeals of General Motors and Chrysler, it seems nearly impossible to believe it, but the help-wanted sign is out at the car makers and their parts suppliers. The Center for Automotive Research predicts the auto industry will add 35,000 jobs this year. One auto supply executive calls it an employee's market. We wondered, is this a true hiring spree? Can this be seen as a return to the glory days of the car industry? Or should we keep our collective guard up for fear of easily sliding back into the dark days of soft sales and layoffs? Let's dig into what's behind these new jobs and how likely the good times are going to last. Joining us is the Chairman Emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research, David Cole. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, David, as we mentioned, your group's expecting the industry to add 35,000 jobs this year. And, of course, we saw the June sales figures and cars and trucks selling at that annual pace, closing in on 16 million vehicles. So that's a level we haven't seen since mid-2007. Would you have predicted such robust hiring and sales activity in 2013 when things were so bad just a few short years ago?
Well, actually, we did. When you consider how low the lows were during the Great Recession, 10.5 million unit sales, there certainly was going to be pent-up demand. We had to see some increase in consumer optimism. So I think we envisioned that there were going to be some strong sales years. We're still not back to some of the peak years that we had a number of years ago, however. So there's still more to go in that respect. The people problem is really a huge issue. And in fact, it's kind of ironic that as the jobs appear, that we don't really have the workforce with the appropriate skills and training to be a part of those jobs or to take those jobs. And this is one of our challenges when you consider that back in the Great Recession, everybody restructured. The big three reduced their capacity by about 3 million units. The job bank disappeared. Tremendous contraction. Now as it is coming back, it's at the same time as the boomer exit is accelerating. So what we have now is a great many people leaving the industry, even at a low base. So there are new jobs. With all of those jobs, even an assembly line job now, is a job that requires people with a fairly substantial amount of education. So it's a very interesting problem that it's not that we don't have the job openings. We don't have the workforce.
And who is most in demand, David? White collar or blue collar, or is it across the board?
It's pretty much across the board, but I was a part of the governor's economic summit last March, and it was interesting when you talk to the business folks, they rank ordered the skill requirements, and number one were skilled trades and technicians. Number two were engineers that have electromechanical skills. Down the list were nurses and doctors, but the problem of job openings and lack of a skilled workforce is pretty much universal right now. It's a huge issue. It's also interesting when you talk about blue collar, and that's what we normally would think about as skilled trades and technicians. For some reason in our society, we have looked at those as second-class jobs. And they are not at all. These are very high-skilled tech jobs. If you go, for example, to Germany, these jobs are really highly revered. People understand how important they are. But for some reason, we began to view that a great job was a part of finance or service or tech, and one of those technician or skilled trade jobs was sort of a low-level job. That's not true at all. These are very high-paying jobs. Require a substantial amount of skill, and it's not a sin to work with your hands. It's ultimately extremely important. It's one of the things that we're very concerned about in our country in general with respect to manufacturing. Manufacturing is an industry that has a very high multiplier, meaning for every job in that industry, there are lots of other jobs. In fact, for a auto manufacturer, it's right at the top of the list. And that multiplier is about 9 or 10, meaning for every job at an auto manufacturer like a GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, whoever, there are 8 or 9 other jobs in the economy, either in suppliers or spinoff jobs. And when you consider that, say, comparison to that really cool Wall Street job with a multiplier of about 2, we have to have manufacturing. We have to make things in our economy if we're going to be a successful country. And we kind of lost that focus.
We're speaking with the chairman emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research, David Cole, looking at the predictions of the auto industry adding 35,000 jobs in 2013. And David, we're seeing this not just with the OEs and the supply base, aren't we?
Across the board. Of course, there's not as many suppliers as there once were. I mean, the restructuring that occurred was just massive. And when you think that what we had expected going into the recession is a recession level of auto sales of about 14 million. But what we got was not a recession, was a depression level down about 10.5 million. So this had a huge impact on the industry. And as I said, with that collapse, plus as we grow, at the same time boomers are exiting, has created a serious talent problem. And that's it's going to continue for some time. But what everybody needs to realize is that even an assembly line worker, that job that somebody could perform literally as a school dropout, requires today a minimum of a 2-year community college degree. It's a different world. Just to kind of tell you a quick little story, let's say three people walked into a factory. They were school dropouts 40 years ago. There was a foreman. The foreman said, just do exactly what I tell you to do repetitively for 8 hours a day and everything will be fine. As you move forward from there, the foreman's gone. It's a self-directed work chain. The technology has changed dramatically. Now it's 40 years after they started that job and they're ready to leave. Those three people are replaced by one person that doesn't not have that 40 years to learn the technology, has to come in knowing the technology. So the minimum education is a 2-year community college degree to replace those three. And then that person has to be committed to a lifelong learning experience because change is continuing at a very rapid rate. It's a different world. And for some reason, we got caught short and we really are not, we don't have the people that are really needed. It's one of the reasons that we're looking at a couple of projects. One is called Building America's Tomorrow, which is not for profit, aimed at getting K through 12 kids to think about manufacturing and related jobs in manufacturing for a career. In most cases, they don't today.
Right.
Another thing we're looking at is what we call the experience connection, to connect retirees that have experience with jobs. For example, GM is bringing back about 200 retirees just to assist with product launches. This is a very experience-based part of the industry when you launch a new product, and they just don't have the people to do it. So it's a very rapidly changing world, and our concern is that we don't have the talent to fill those 35,000 jobs. And it's kind of like a few years ago we were talking about offshoring for cheap labor. You know, let's go to China, let's go to Indonesia, let's find cheap labor.
Sure.
Now we have become so productive that you could assemble a car in China, for example, at zero cost, and the cost of transportation is greater than the labor savings. Mm-hmm. So what we're concerned about now is not offshoring for cheap labor, it's offshoring for skilled labor because we don't have it here. Lean is not good enough anymore. It's lean agile, the ability to shift and change. If you look at where they make bodies, we think of that as the body shop. Everything is driven by software and robots. And the technicians that are required to deal with those issues are very sophisticated people. They have to have hands-on skills. They have to understand how things work, not be afraid to get their hands dirty, but they have to have a lot of mind power to be able to function. There was an interesting story in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago about Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is a big manufacturing center.
Yes.
Very high unemployment, lots of job openings, and a mismatch between those that wanted jobs and those that the skills that those jobs required. And then they had a little short piece on the local community college that was training technicians and skilled tradespeople, and it was only running at 70% of capacity.
Hmm.
Somehow we have not brought the message to our population that there are great jobs. These are jobs of the future, and people are not focusing on the education to prepare for those jobs.
Now, let's talk about the future, David Cole. How long do you think this is going to last? We look at this, do we want to call this a hiring spree, or do we want to be more wary with the way we characterize it?
I think it's going to last for some time. If you look just at the boomer issue, we're just into that period. And to give you a couple of numbers, in 5 years in our general economy, and this is all kinds of skilled jobs, will be short about 10 million skilled people because of the size of the boomers compared to the follow-on generation. And in 15 years, that grows to 30 million. So what we're talking about is a very substantial demand push for some time. And for young people that have the skill, it's a terrific opportunity. For people that don't have the education and skill, it's going to be a pretty dismal period.
We've been talking about the auto industry hiring spree. Chairman Emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research, David Cole, has been our guest. David, thank you so much for being on the program.
It has been my total pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts and your suggestions. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Click on the link that says Stateside. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, that's C-A-N-T-Y, and on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And to those of you joining us for the first time this week on Interlochen Public Radio, please get in touch. We would love to hear from you and get your thoughts on stories we should cover and people we should profile here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. Still to come, we continue our week-long look series asking immigrants in Michigan just what America means to them. We'll hear from a man from the African nation of Togo. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the best things about sharing each other's stories is how we can learn from each other. And especially as Michigan has weathered the Great Recession, so many people in our state have had to face challenging periods, times when money was tight, when you dreaded finding another past due notice in the mailbox or a phone call from a creditor. Then you factor in the challenges of becoming a single parent, trying to raise a family and stretch a dollar, and then do it while you're trying to hold on to a farm. That's the story my next guest shares in her new book, Bootstrapper, a memoir from broke to badass on a northern Michigan farm, published by Knopf, and author Marty Jo Link joins us here in the studio. Such a pleasure to meet you after I spent this time with you going through this year in your life, Marty Jo. Wow.
Oh, thanks, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
Well, you really have quite the story as you share with us. It's the month-by-month account of the year your marriage collapsed. You were literally, and I mean literally, living hand-to-mouth on your farm near Traverse City. So start by telling us about the farm that you called home, Big Valley, and your three boys as this year was unfolding.
Right. Capital H on the home. I just really felt like that was where I was made to be. And I had this dream of raising my sons with a rural lifestyle, and I just wasn't willing to give that up. It was 6 acres. We had 2 horses, 25 chickens. We raised 2 piglets with friends and dogs, cats, and all of that. But we also had just a great big vegetable garden. And that really, that sustained us for that year.
Well, your determination is some might say, wow, she was a little pig-headed about this whole farm thing because she probably could have sold it. Taken that money, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So the marriage, as we meet you in this book, in your memoir, your marriage is ending. Marriage of how long?
Right, 19 years.
And you very slyly talk about sitting on your porch sucking down a beer, watching Mr. Wonderful across the street taking out his garbage, and then we realize Mr. Wonderful is your ex. So you
right.
were across the street from your ex.
Yeah, and that was his idea. We thought it would be easier for the kids, and I think in a way it was. I wanted the book to focus month by month so readers could really get an idea of what that year was like. And there was a lot of fun, but there was a lot of heartache and difficulty, too.
And without necessarily going through all the details, because people want to read it, and we don't want to give away all of it, but it was one setback and challenge and thing after another. And I wondered, was that a new thing for you, or were you one of these people where bad luck tended to follow you? I mean, were you used to dealing with the kind of adversity that you had to with you had the bill collectors
right.
nipping at your heels constantly? Was that new for you?
That was very new for me. I've always had that stubborn streak, but I was raised in suburbia with 2 very doting and working parents, and I had a pretty average, pretty wonderful childhood. So that was all very new to me. And it did seem to just come in waves, one right after the other, right after the other.
It truly did. And one of the things that I wondered as I'm reading this is, when is this woman going to catch a break? But talk first about some of the good things that you remember from that year. I mean, it's the process of learning to live as a single parent and your boys learning to live with mom and dad not being together.
Right. That was difficult for all of us. It was difficult for all five of us.
Sure.
I think the good times was how much time the four of us spent together, how much just time I spent with my three sons. Because I needed them to help me so much, they weren't enrolled in a lot of outside activities. And so we just spent a whole lot of time together. I mean, we even roasted marshmallows inside over our fireplace. So it was kind of old-fashioned time, but it was precious.
Well, in fact, I really do get the sense it was very retro in some of the ways that you insisted that they do things. In fact, you were sick with the flu and you said to them, go watch TV, and their jaws hit the floor because mom never wants us to go watch TV.
Right, right. And I was determined that my boys were not going to grow up in front of screens. I'm not against technology. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on Facebook. I have a website. But I just felt like they needed to experience a childhood like I did. Build tree forts, learn about bugs and nature, plant a garden, get their knees skinned and have the sunshine on their heads. That's what I wanted for my boys.
I'm speaking with author Marty Jo Link, whose book Bootstrapper, a memoir from broke to badass on a northern Michigan farm, is now out from Knopf. How bad, Marty, in that year as the you separate, the divorce is looming down the road in a few months, a long, long winter. Reminded me of the Laura Ingalls Wilder book, The Long Winter, when you think about all the things that happened to Ma and Pa Ingalls during that terrible winter and kind of evoke that in the Traverse City area. So many years ago. How bad did it get?
Right. Well, we got, I think, 110 inches of snow that winter, which is an awful lot. We average maybe 85. So we got an extra amount of snow. And I live in a farmhouse that on the deed, it says year built plus or minus 1900. So it's old. And when it was built, nobody knew much about insulation. And it had been added on over the years. So really keeping warm turned out to be quite an undertaking. We managed to do it, but it took a lot of work. We ended up burning an awful lot of wood in our fireplace.
Thank God, because it hit you. The fireplace was made to warm, not just for ambiance, not just for, oh, it's nice to have a fireplace, but there's a serious reason for this fireplace.
Right, right. How silly of me not to realize that at the time.
But you really, now we should back up and say, yes, you were working.
I was working. I was doing some freelance writing and editing. And that money pretty much, I think I calculated maybe 70 to 72% of that went to pay our mortgage. We had a crazy big mortgage. And in retrospect, I might have done something differently if I knew everything we were going to be faced with.
All
but
right.
I didn't know.
That's
no,
true.
I didn't know.
Yeah. You didn't. You didn't know that next month some other awful thing was going to
right.
happen.
Right. And so when you're living it, you just take things as they come. You just deal with them as they arrive. It just so happened that in that year, an awful lot of things arrived.
And were you getting help from Mr. Wonderful? And by the way, I must say you do a terrific job of maintaining privacy. And that's really good. Unless someone knew you personally, they wouldn't know who your ex was. But
right.
we do get a feeling that, you know, there was reasons that you felt you needed to move on and go in another direction. But
right. And he continued to be involved in the kids' mm-hmm. lives. He paid every child support payment on time, exactly how, you know, we had scheduled it. He was very good about that. He did not know that we were in the dire straits that we were. I didn't really share that with anyone. I was too stubborn and probably too proud to do that.
And the boys didn't say, Dad, guess what? Mom didn't even have enough peanut butter for my sandwich at school.
Well, I'm not sure even the boys knew, because they've since read the book and they've said to me, you know, Mom, we remember all those incidents, but we just thought it was fun. We just thought it was an adventure. We didn't understand how desperate the circumstances were. And I did try to shield them from some of that worry. I didn't want children to have to deal with adult worries.
Which I bet it's tempting to lean on who's ever around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we hear shouldn't happen, but does, as parents kind of almost treat that child as maybe a peer instead of being a parent.
Right.
So you kind of put your big girl pants on. And I love that, you know, you did pull yourself up by the bootstraps. I thought about the contrast when you went to your mom and dad's, and I didn't know where they lived, but it was clearly comfortable. It was suburban. It was not out on the farm. And you had this big turkey dinner, and then you went home and had Christmas dinner standing around with hot dogs at the fire. But I thought it was you made a delicious transition into making it an adventure for the boys.
Right.
And so that was the way you approached that.
Yeah, I did. And my parents have this beautiful design sense, and their house is lovely inside. And so the kids, I felt like the kids got to experience both. They got to experience kind of both sides of Christmas, that side and also the more rustic outdoor side. And I mean, if we were roasting hot dogs over the campfire, they just thought that that was fun.
I had to wonder, because there you were in your 1900, give or take, circa farmhouse with all of its attendant problems. You had the wolf at the door, figuratively speaking, and literally,
right?
Because you did have that happen when you had chicken grabbed by Mrs. Donahue. The chicken was grabbed by a wolf. Was it never tempting to go, Mom, Dad, you know what? Could we come home for a while? Did that ever cross your mind?
I think I thought about it, but I knew my parents are very practical people, and I knew in my heart they would tell me, sell the house. Anybody would have told me, sell the house. So I already knew the good advice that they would have given me, and so I wasn't ready to hear that. I said, if we can do it month to month, I can outlast it. And I think essentially that's what we did. I mean, we did suffer, and there were times when I was really afraid for our future, but we outlasted it. And that's what felt like a success.
And that is something that I got a sense, you know, without spilling all the stories in your book, that the story you tell of just outgutting it. I'm just not, you know, your dad says put your daubers up. So you did. You put your daubers up. And you didn't let it beat you. That is a lesson that anyone can learn from, because the question would be, you know, what would people living in a city or living in a suburb be able to take from the story of a single mom trying to raise her kids on a farm in northern Michigan?
Right. And I think that we have some of us have lost the reward of hard physical labor. Sometimes getting over something takes not just emotional resilience, but hard physical labor. And we did that. I mean, we worked with our muscles as well as our minds that year. And so, you know, get up off the couch, work. And I hope that I've passed that to my boys. They're all three of them are hard workers.
You shed light for all of your readers on what it means to be the working poor. And as you explain, that's not how you grew up. So that voyage for the year, what did that teach you about when we hear that term, the working poor? There are stories behind that term.
Right. There certainly are stories. And I think we pigeonhole people to think, well, they're lazy or uneducated. You know, I had a college degree, and I certainly wasn't lazy, and I found myself in that circumstance. So I would encourage people to take a second thought when they want to pigeonhole someone.
Marty Jo Link is the author of Bootstrapper, a memoir from broke to badass on a northern Michigan farm. The story of how she hung onto her home and her farm in the midst of a divorce, financial problems, and all the other challenges that come with living on a farm that's over a century old. Now, my good friend Susan and her husband are about to move from a townhouse in an Oakland County suburb to a small cottage on about an acre in a nearby Oakland County town. And one of her top priorities is to start keeping chickens in her new backyard. And it seems she's not alone. Backyard chicken raising is on the rise all across the state and all across the nation. We just heard from Marty Jo Link, who raised chickens on her farm, but it's a farm, so it's something you'd expect. But there are now ordinances that let people keep chickens in Ann Arbor, Flint, Detroit, Lansing, Grand Rapids, Traverse City, and many other Michigan communities. Taylor Reed's the founder of BeginningFarmers.org. Taylor is a PhD candidate in community food and agriculture at Michigan State University. He joins us from East Lansing. Taylor, tell us, why is backyard chicken keeping on the rise?
I think it's an outgrowth of a larger local food and farm movement that's seen an enormous increase in demand for natural and local food from consumers and chefs. Even a number of large grocery chains have gotten into the act, and coincides with the growth of and growing popularity of community gardens and farmers markets and those kinds of things.
Now, I have to imagine not everyone's on board with this urban chicken farming. So what are the potential problems that could arise from deciding, yes, you want to keep chickens in your backyard?
Well, I think that neighbors are concerned about noise and smells. In my experience, those issues are usually ameliorated once people actually start having chickens in their backyard and their neighbors start getting fresh eggs from them sometimes and realize that in most localities, roosters are not allowed and hens are not noisy.
Okay.
The dogs in my neighborhood cause a heck of a lot more racket than the chickens that used to be in my neighbor's backyard 10 feet from my bedroom window.
Well, what would you say would be the main do's and don'ts of successful backyard chicken farming?
I think that one of the most important things is to talk to your neighbors, let them know you're doing it, and give them as much information you can about the fact that it's safe, it's healthy, it's not noisy, it's not stinky, and that it's something that has been passed by a number of really large cities with much more dense populations than most, including Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City.
Taylor Reed's working on his PhD in community food and agriculture at Michigan State University, and he's the founder of BeginningFarmers.org. And you can also learn more at BackyardChickens.com, which is one of my favorite website names of all time, BackyardChickens.com. And Taylor is, again, his site is BeginningFarmers.org. Taylor, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
On this week of July 4th, we're profiling immigrants to this country, and we're asking them, what does America mean to you? Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has this profile of Kofi Etito. Kofi fled the small West African nation of Togo in 2004. Now he helps other refugees through his work at Freedom House in Detroit.
My name is Zaini Kofi Etito. I'm from Togo. I left Togo in 2004. Because of a political reason. You know, Togo is a dictatorship country. If you don't follow the party, they take you like enemy. I just left to save my life. And when I land at New York, I don't know exactly where to go because I've never been there before. And at the airport, I found a black man. And fortunately, it was a Togolese too. When I spoke with him, he said, oh, I can help you. And he took me home. And after a week, he came back and told me, Kofi, I cannot help you here, but I found some place which is in Michigan, so I can help you go there. I arrived here at around midnight, and I say, I thank God because all this, God helped me a lot, and I live here. If you don't help me get my asylum, and 5 years later, I apply for my citizen, and last year, I got my citizenship. After I get here, I saw that it wasn't easy because the culture, the language, how people live here is very, very different. And I started worrying at that time. It wasn't easy to find a job. But with God's help, I found a job, and I started managing my life, building my new life, and bringing my family here. You know, working at Freedom House is also a blessing for me because my job, I like helping people. So when I open the door and they see me like confident, they know that, oh, for me, I can succeed too, like Kofi succeed here. All my future is here now. You know, I put all my hope here. I said America is a great country. I'm very happy. I can say whatever I want. I always tell my wife that I think God is in this country.
And you can find out more about Freedom House online at freedomhousedetroit.org. And we thank Sarah Swick for that profile. Still to come, we will keep our eye on the 4th of July, but we will travel back in time. How Independence Day was celebrated more than a century ago in Michigan. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With the 4th of July at hand, it's a pretty good bet many of us have a backyard barbecue in our plans, or maybe catching a fireworks show, maybe even doing one of your own in your backyard. That got us thinking about the ways Michiganders have marked the big national holiday over the centuries. And for that, of course, we turn to our official Stateside historian. Bill Loomis writes for the Detroit News, and he's the author of Detroit's Delectable Past, Two Centuries of Frog Legs, Pigeon Pie, and Drugstore Whiskey. Welcome back, Bill.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Well, it certainly seems that none other than John Adams was the one who kind of threw down the gauntlet and told us, go out and celebrate Independence Day.
Yeah, absolutely. And almost everything he listed in the famous letter to his wife about how this should be a solemn day and should for the history be celebrated, all those things people took literally. So that is a quote that comes up repeatedly every year in the newspapers. And with these civic groups that are planning their holidays, they use that as kind of a mission statement.
In fact, here it is. He wrote to Abigail and he talked about this Independence Day, and he said it ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. I don't think we have a lot of that today.
Not anymore.
It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this confinement continent to the other from this time forward forevermore. So we Americans went, yeah. Sounds pretty good. Sounds like a party.
Right, right, exactly. And illuminations are fireworks, so
yes.
You know, everything on there.
Well, take us back, Bill Loomis, to those early 4th of July celebrations.
Well, the earliest ones really kind of began in Philadelphia. They didn't occur in Detroit until after really the War of 1812, because there just weren't that many Americans that lived in Detroit.
And so the French who were here were not celebrating
they
the 4th of July.
They didn't get it. They had their own things, but they went along with it once it started picking up and once the immigration of New Englanders really came into the city.
So the New Englanders were celebrating mm-hmm. through the end of the 18th century, and then we start getting into the early 1800s, and mm-hmm. they've moved to Detroit.
Absolutely.
So what did they bring with them?
They brought with them a lot of their kind of obscure celebrations that we don't see anymore, like the March of the Horribles.
What was the March of the Horribles?
That was like a Mardi Gras parade, if you will. The adults would dress up, the men would dress up in these kind of goofy outfits and march around. That was a very popular New England celebration that occurred. I found it in a record in 1838 in Northville, and they were still doing the March of the Horribles.
Love that name. I think
know.
Somebody needs to revive the March of the Horribles.
And they were and launching anvils. That was another practice that was quite common. Anvils, you know, they weigh about 100 pounds.
Yes.
And you'd fill up the bottom, which was concave, with gunpowder. And they'd seal it with one report I said seal it with bent playing cards, keep okay. the gunpowder in.
Okay.
They'd put it down, and they'd light it, and it would blast off about 100, 200 feet. And that was an exciting thing to do.
That was exciting. Probably dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous.
I mean.
But, you know, that was just something that happened. They blew off lots of muskets and lots of blank cartridges. And they didn't have fireworks. They would throw flaming balls of cotton back and forth. That was something else they did. They'd soak cotton balls in turpentine and kind of play a catch. Sometimes they'd coat their hands with flour paste to keep from getting burned. But it didn't really work for a while.
So as the 19th century went on then, it just kind of gelled. There were parades.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that wasn't all. They didn't all do just fireworks. They had parades. They had they really did begin by going to church. But they'd have parades. Lewis Cass's farm was a parade ground. And they would have an oration and a reading of the Declaration of Independence. So it was a little more solemn, but they definitely – and they didn't all have the glorious fireworks that we have today. But they certainly could blow off cannons and muskets, and they did plenty of that.
And they had them there to do.
Yes, they
did. Was eating a part of this too, the way it has become for us today?
Oh, yeah. Eating was a big part of 4th of July. Early on, they didn't have the kind of things we'd recognize. They had a lot of turtle soup and maybe roast oysters was common, and different puddings and things. But later on, they would have picnics, and it was a little different. They would a lot of times bring a roast, a pre-roasted like veal or something like that, and cut that up. They had deviled eggs. They had lots of what they used to call bill of fare included hard-boiled eggs and deviled eggs. They ate on – later on, around 1890s, they started eating on wooden plates, and those were the equivalent of our paper plates.
Okay.
They would eat those. They were nice and light, and then you could just throw them away or burn them. They used what were called Japanese napkins that were made out of rice paper. One of the problems they had with sandwiches was they didn't have a way to keep them from getting dried out.
Mm.
They had later something called paraffin paper, which was a wax paper, but it was not common. So it was hard, and there were no Tupperware, obviously. So
no, didn't have those little glad snap.
One suggestion from a housewife said, put the sandwiches in old candy boxes because they were kind of small. And you could use them like that. But they would get ice from they sold ice at the train stations a lot of times. So they'd get a block of ice and wrap it in paper, and that would keep the cucumbers cold.
I'm speaking with Bill Loomis, who's the author of Detroit's Delectable Past, Two Centuries of Frog Legs, Pigeon Pie, and Drugstore Whiskey. And we'd like to get Bill in at each holiday to kind of look back and see how we celebrated in Michigan. And, of course, really with Detroit being the largest city in Michigan, Detroit kind of set the standard, didn't it, Bill, as far as what the official celebrations were like?
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like now the big celebrations were in Detroit, mm-hmm. but every little community had their own. And, in fact, Detroit didn't have a citywide fireworks. They had – each neighborhood had their own.
Okay.
They had a grand parade, they called it, and this was after the Civil War. They had, you know, floats and parades. And I mean, anybody who was anybody was in the parade. The parade at one point was 5 miles long all the way down Woodward. The firemen alone were 1 mile long.
That's a serious
so
parade.
Everybody wanted to be in the – I think there's more people in the parade than watching the parade.
And boat rides, I take it, because you were on the mm-hmm. river.
Yeah, boat rides. There was in 1870s, there were 100,000 people that went to Belle Isle and to some of the other little neighborhoods because it's a little cooler.
Mm.
And that was big fun to go on the boat rides up and down the river and stuff.
Now, you mentioned the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Let's revisit the Civil War because there was a big, big victory
right
on 4th of July, wasn't there?
Yeah, the Siege of Vicksburg mm-hmm. was a major victory for the Union. And the dispatches of the victory came right on the 4th of July day.
Right there in 1863, right? Just, phew, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So during the Civil War, the celebrations were a little less quaint and fun and much more intense and emotional. They used to light bonfires on 4th of July, mm-hmm. children again. That was a very common thing. And during the Civil War, they'd have them all the way up and down Woodward, these bonfires and down the major thoroughfares. And it was much more immediate. The thought of losing the country or the Union was much more real.
Yes. In fact, I think about the Battle of Gettysburg going on 150 years ago right now.
That's
right. Leading up to the 4th of July. So
yeah.
There was some very serious.
Yeah, there was a certain serious undertone. Aspect to the whole thing. And was not just like other parades.
So as we move beyond the Civil War, we get into the 20th century.
Yeah.
I get the feeling from reading your piece in the Detroit, things really got dangerous.
Yeah, it was amazing how that happened. Fireworks that children was the domain of children basically, and teenagers, they were not like just noisemakers. They were not – firecrackers were a separate entity.
Okay.
If you read the classifieds right around the 4th of July, they're selling fireworks, you know, big ads for fireworks in the newspapers. And so this was like around 1868 up through 1910. And these – you know, one fellow selling Navy ordnance, signaling ordnance, and dynamite caps strong enough to blow cars off of rails. And they would have cannon crackers and torpedo crackers, which were filled with dynamite. And they – small amounts, and they would shoot off and like rockets. And it was just – you know, you just think, what were these parents thinking? Because the next day they would list all the injuries in the paper on the 5th of July.
Mm-mm-mm.
They would have a table and they would show the list of all the possible injuries. And they were horrific. I mean, starting from age 2 on up to adults. And then how many occurred. The New York Times reported nationwide, I think it was 1909, 38 people died. And a couple thousand were seriously injured. Another problem they had was people would get lockjaw from tetanus from the powder burns. It opened up their skin to this powder would go deep into the skin. So on top of losing your fingers, you got these other problems as well.
Tetanus to deal with as well.
Yeah, really.
And you talk about some of the awful pranks that were pulled. Like you were talking about a doctor on Michigan Avenue. The poor guy's just trying to crank his car in 1902.
I know. It was sort of like, imagine those old little rascal silent movies they're, you know, but it wasn't funny. And they would really throw these fireworks into open streetcars, and they throw them at dogs and horses.
The poor doctor wound up getting his face smashed into the grill of his car.
Right. Yeah, well, it startled him, and he jumped up and smashed his head into the car. Another lady just walking down the street, and they fired a rocket and it hit her in the ear. So, I mean, these were awful, and most of the people were not doing anything. You know, they're just trying to get to work.
So the idea, I guess, is you were going to sacrifice fingers to celebrate the independence of the nation.
It's part of patriotism, of some weird thinking, but that was kind of the thinking until 1903, when there was a campaign. Actually, what started it was the city of Portland, Maine, was burned to the ground from fireworks, people throwing fireworks. That was kind of a wake-up call. And they started a campaign to have a what they used to call safe and sane 4th of July. And by 1910, they did.
So they began to outlaw things and regulate things.
The big fireworks with dynamite in them. And they had very short fuses. These were not – if you look at the pictures of the kids in the paper, these things are like a foot long. They're just enormous. Mm-hmm. And so they switched over to smaller fireworks and that sort of thing.
And then you kind of track the fact that as you get into the early 20th century, and maybe they gave up, the blowing up of dynamite, got into things like baseball and picnics, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. The baseball games were everywhere. If you look at the list on 4th of July, you can find every neighborhood had an amateur baseball game. And the Tigers, you could go see the Tigers play. Cleveland or Toledo, they would play. And so that went on all day. They would have sometimes 2-3 games in one day. And it would be J.L. Hudson's versus some other local Stroh's Beer or something like that. Every group had an amateur team. And it was a beautiful, beautiful day. You know, they would have a picnic, and there was the lemonade guy and the different guys selling firecrackers, of course. He was everywhere. You'd spread out your enameled they called them enameled cloth. It was sort of an oiled cloth that you could sit on.
All right.
And just have a wonderful day.
And when did we begin to see, particularly in Detroit, I mean, they just had the huge International Freedom Fireworks, and I know Hudson's for years sponsored it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the spectacular displays in the entire nation. Where did that begin and when?
That really began in Detroit after the turn of the century.
Okay.
There were neighborhood fireworks. Mm. There was not a citywide firework in Detroit. So you'd go to the North Woodward Residents Association fireworks, and I think that was – or the Clark Park had big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get thousands of people, but not like now with a million spectators.
Sure.
But they would get, say, 20,000 people. And, you know, the descriptions of these fireworks were pretty cool. The Eiffel Tower they would do and the Niagara Falls, and they would blow them off. And then afterward they might have a dance or something else. So it went on all night long. But, that came later after the 1910s.
Well, it certainly seems, Bill Loomis, as we think about the 4th of July, and then you contrast that with Memorial Day. I mean, Memorial Day with those very somber roots.
Yeah.
This one we really did have permission to go out and celebrate.
Oh, yeah. This was the go-nuts thing, and this was get in the parade. And they'd have, you know, these elaborate floats, everybody was involved. They really just loved it.
Well, I'm happy to kind of think that in one respect we have gotten safer as the decades have gone on. You don't have quite as many – you don't have pages and pages of accidents and maimings because people were celebrating the 4th. That's terrible.
Yeah, even they thought that was getting way out of control. So that's good to know.
So it sounds like overall we have gotten a little more smart. And maybe a little more sedate in our 4th of July celebrations.
Yeah, you know, you forget. You think, wow, it's kind of wild on 4th of July night, but it's really nothing like it used to be. So, yes, it's a lot better. And It's a lot more fun, I think.
Bill Loomis, writer for the Detroit News, also the author of Detroit's Delectable Past, 2 centuries of Frog Legs, Pigeon Pie, and Drugstore Whiskey. Thanks for the look back over the years, Bill.
Thanks, Cindy.
All right, back to this century now. Well, actually, the year 2012, when a new state law was passed that allowed larger and louder fireworks to be sold and launched in Michigan. But this year, things could be a little quieter in your town than they were when that law was first passed. That's after a raft of complaints prompted state lawmakers to tweak the law, allowing local governments to ban overnight use of consumer-grade fireworks on and around holidays. Andy Webb is owner of Captain Boom Fireworks in Otsego. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
Andy, you got the ball rolling on that fireworks law that was passed last year, and I'm wondering, what did relaxing the fireworks statute in Michigan mean for dealers like you?
Well, it allowed us to sell legally to Michigan residents. I had been selling over the internet to out-of-state residents, and basically it allowed Michigan residents to purchase and use fireworks that they used to have to drive out-of-state to get.
Now, we will have to say, and I know based on our neighborhood, there were changes in the frequency of fireworks being set off and at different hours. Can you talk to us more about the change that Lieutenant Governor Calley recently signed into law? What was behind that?
When the law was originally put in place, it was felt that communities would be able to regulate discharge at various hours based on the noise ordinances that they currently had.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was found that it was more difficult to do that, and by codifying some time limits, you know, after midnight or 1 a.m. for various size communities, that allowed local communities to have a little tighter control over specifically noise related to fireworks use.
Yeah, I think even though you sell fireworks at Captain Boom Fireworks, and that's, you probably couldn't dispute the fact it's not real delightful to hear fireworks at 2 a.m.,
you know, yeah. People have to be reasonable. And I think one of the things that we'll see is after 2 or 3 years of this, it will become more normal. You know, the novelty will wear off, and they'll use fireworks in a responsible manner.
What got you into fireworks, Andy? I mean, you own Captain Boom now. What drew you to this field?
Well, it was a few years ago, back in 1979. I met some people that had a fireworks business, and I like to say that being 19 years old with a Y chromosome, I was qualified. And so I said, hey, if you ever need some help, let me know. And they did.
And here you are now, all these years later, and I'm sure you know from fireworks.
Yeah. It's been, this is my 34th season doing professional displays. Usually people look at my fingers to see if I have them all, and I do. The important thing is to do it safely. So, you know, I would say for consumers, have some water on hand. Don't drink while you're using them. Maybe wear a pair of gloves and some safety glasses, perhaps some earplugs when you're up close to them. And just be reasonable. You can really have a great show and be safe and have a lot of fun.
Andy Webb owns Captain Boom Fireworks, and he joined us from his store in Otsego. Andy, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineers today were Tony Brown and Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.